Welcome to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto. And today we're talking to Dina Burke and Natasha Hoskins, who are the co-founders of Boys Club, which is a media and creative studio and community. Their tagline for their social presence and also their very funny newsletters is "For dumb smart people and or smart dumb people, relatable." Mm-hmm. And they put together newsletters, podcasts, parties, magazines, and events. Like I said, it's also a social collective for people trying to understand fintech and crypto and the way that it fits in with the broader culture. I've known them for...
I certainly don't understand that myself.
Well,
so
we'll help you out today. I'm excited to yap with them. I've known them for a while. We're also working on a project together that will debut early next month, which we teased in Ad Week, which is Dirt's new vertical clone in collaboration with Boys Club. And it is Drudge for Technology and Culture. Mm. We just finalized the landing page. It's looking really slick. So I'm excited to dig into that more.
Congratulations, Daisy.
Thank you.
I can recall around the time that this podcast started, you know, that you did have a profile in the New York Times where you were really talking up the verticals. You've launched like three verticals since that New York Times
piece. Yeah, we are expanding at a frenetic pace, perhaps against mm-hmm. my better judgment, but
the primordial soup is bubbling.
Well, in the words of Don Draper, my life moves in one direction forward. So, as does the Dirtyverse.
Mm-hmm. Don't universes like spiral? No, that's galaxies.
We don't know. They do a lot of different things.
We could ask Katy Perry.
You know, this could be a black hole situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk about an article that you wrote this week, Francis.
Oh.
About the creator economy, which is something I know that you're always kind of coming up with a rolling definition of what it means to be a creator and what that means to your guests. But I think that you have like a pretty great formula for what it means to be a participant in the creator economy, where you have to have three attributes. And I can think of a lot of people and entities that have like two out of three.
Mm-hmm.
But you really need to be firing on all cylinders. So can you explain a little bit about the criteria that you lay out?
Yes. So this is rooted in an idea that's not mine originally. I got it from the newsletter growth professional, Matt McGarry, who I think he got it from one of the Morning Brew co-founders, but that the idea is that you create media, you grow the audience for it, and you sell it. And my argument in the creator economy article was that basically there are people and service and software service providers in each of these columns or task groups, I would say. But that one thing that differentiates creators from a lot of like larger media companies is a media company usually has all of these vertically integrated, whereas mm-hmm. a creator usually is just doing one or two of these, very rarely three. And everything else is outsourced either to service providers or to a platform. Like if you're on YouTube, then you're outsourcing the growth and parts of your monetization too. But let's put a pin in it because our guests are here.
Right on time.
Did you guys see there's like this new Paul Brothers TV show, and there's the clip.
Oh my gosh.
I think it's Jake Paul. And he's like, look, I don't want to sound like, you know, like some woke asshole, but women actually have it kind of hard.
I saw this. I saw this and I was like, I think I might tune into this show.
I was like, Jake Paul, welcome to Boys Club.
Having Jake Paul on Dumb Bitch Hour would go really hard, actually.
It would.
Like,
what about Chet Hanks? I'm sure he's not busy.
Mm.
Oh my gosh, Chet Hanks. Dream but guest. Only if he comes on and does is Petois. In his Jamaican mm-hmm. persona.
I think the algorithm might Jamaican. Punish you for that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I think I saw him like in front of the Wall Street Bowl a few months ago. Likely place for him to be.
Likely place for him to be.
I was like, oh my God, I went to Bowdoin with that guy. And then I was like,
you nope, did?
That's Chet Hanks. No, I just, you know, when you see somebody and you're like, oh my God, my friend from college. And then mm-hmm. you're like, nope, celebrity.
What were you doing in front of the bowl? the stock
market. I can't disclose.
She was in line to take a picture, obviously.
Actually, Francis can confirm that the National Writers Union headquarters is directly behind the Wall Street Bull and next to Cipriani, because that's where you would expect the foremost labor movement for American writers to be located, just right in the belly of the beast. And every time I go there, it's really funny.
Yeah, I can't say that that's a place that I've been recently. Was Chet doing like a press, like was it a press moment for him? Or
they said was Chet coming from Pret? And I was like, wow, this is what we were talking about on the last episode, where I'm like, I have these great ideas for brands, and unfortunately, I don't know them. But like, if Chet anyone can get in touch with Pret, you guys need to do a Chet and Pret Oprah Uma situation, because culture demands it. What was he doing? No, he was just walking. I think he had like maybe a gym bag.
I see.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, I want to introduce an idea I read earlier today in an article that did not come out like a couple weeks ago, but it's by Drew Austin. The New Vice. It's called Obituary for Millennial Culture. And there was this paragraph that stood out to me, which I'll read. After all, millennials have nowhere to go. The internet is where they live. The boomers own property and land in lieu of more traditional assets. The wealth that millennials accumulated online is their generational nest egg. We often ridiculed boomers for being unable to grow up, but at least they had something else to move on to, writes the literary essayist Chris Jesu Lee. At this rate, millennials look to be fighting for TikTok territory against Zoomers as every single one of us enters middle age. So I think we're all millennials here. So I wanted to get your thoughts.
Wow, yeah. I hate that. Well, Dina has real estate.
I'm Dina's an elder a millennial, if it helps. I can qualify myself that way. Wow, that hits hard.
Yeah, I feel like there's something actually quite comforting about the idea. Like, I have every once in a while these moments where I'm like, is this a me issue or is this like a global note for my age range? And so I actually hear something like that, and as it is depressing in some ways, because I think if all of our identity and ownership and sense of belonging is on the internet, that feels extremely ephemeral and unstable. But at the same time, it's kind of nice to know that like misery loves company, that we're all sort of in it together, and this is not a product of my own personal failing, but someone somewhere made some mistakes and I'm paying the consequences now.
Yeah.
Which feels a little better.
As somebody who's like built my business online as well, like I have these moments where I'm like, well, it's fine if all of this doesn't work out because this isn't my real life. And it's like, really? That's not your real life? Talk about dumb bitch hour. It's like, you're on there every waking moment. That's not your real life. Like, somebody call Annie Dillard, because that's how you're spending your days, bitch. Like,
I actually met a guy at a party this weekend, and he was like, we were just chatting, and then he was like, so you've mentioned Twitter like three times in this, it was a short conversation, in this conversation, like, are you online a lot? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm online a lot. And he was like, oh, okay. Like, I'd like to get your handle so that when I get home and get on my iPad, I can look you up on Twitter.
Not an iPad, was like, baby. Was this family?
I was like, excuse me, sir, call the police. You only have Twitter on your iPad? And he was like, yeah, you know, like, I don't want to be just like, have that available to me at all times. And it was like a real, like, whoa, cold water to the face type moment, where I'm like, that is a different relationship to the internet that I have, that you're pulling out a bigger screen to clock some Twitter time. Like, that's a different vibe completely.
Well, you know, Daisy famously only has, she doesn't have the app, she only has it on her browser on her phone.
Well, famously now. Yeah, I tried to wean myself off Twitter like a while ago by removing the app from my phone, so I have to log into the Safari browser.
Does that help?
No.
No,
it just, like, I'm still am on there all the time, and
you're just having a worse user experience.
Having a worse user experience. But yeah, thanks.
You need to introduce more friction. I'm very pro friction. I think this is one of the pedestals I like to get onto on this podcast, but I'm more and more convinced that like the attempts to remove friction in every stage of our life, i.e. that new startup Cluely that we all saw the video for, where he's got the glasses on and it's like telling him how to convince this woman that he's a 30-year-old professional. The removal of friction is literally death. The end result of a frictionless culture, of frictionless software, is literally death.
You're right, Francis. I'm just going to say, because we're all thinking of it, Twitter needs to be ribbed for her pleasure. Reintroduce friction.
Oh, no. How would you rib Twitter? How would you rib Twitter?
That wasn't a real suggestion.
I want to go here. Besides removing the app, how can we make, like, do you have to, like, is it okay? No scroll. You have to press like an arrow to scroll.
Wait. Actually, I have something relevant to say, which is my friend Lucas texted me and he's like, did I tell you about 48? Mind you, I don't text. I haven't texted with him in like 2 years. And I was like, no, what is it? And he's like, it's an app I made. You can only follow 48 people and you can only post once every 48 hours. It's on a 48-hour delay.
That's so funny.
I'm in here right now with 12 or 15 chuckle fucks. My first post was pee pee poo poo because I was like, that'll be relevant in 48 hours. And maybe the answer is 48. So you guys can beg Lucas for an invite code.
I'm going to send him a DM after this. He won't get it for 48 hours. I've done this a little bit with Instagram, where like my Instagram was hacked and then deleted.
Was this around the same time your seed phrase was hacked, or separate incidents?
Separate time. I have really bad OPSEC.
Yeah.
Just truly tremendously bad.
Regular heat over
great
here.
To work in. Yeah, it's really
Dina
bad.
Texted me her seed phrase yesterday and I thought I was having a stroke. Just no warning, just like, dear poetry door. It's like, it's happening. It's finally happening. I've lost my mind.
Dirt prompt. Whoa, what's your seed phrase?
I love it. Okay, sorry, Natasha, keep it quiet.
Oh, no, all good. Anyway, no, this was like 2 years ago. And then I was off Instagram for a while. And then I started Instagram again. And I have tried to keep it under 100 people that I follow. Mm-hmm. So I will very regularly go through and like unfollow a bunch of people.
That's so chic.
And thank you. And like the main reason is like, I don't want to have parasocial relationships with people that I follow on Instagram. Like I want to be like, these are people, if I can't pick up the phone and call you, then I shouldn't follow you on Instagram. Mm-hmm. That's my feeling. But it does get difficult because I do think people take it personally when they get unfollowed.
They're Natasha, like, I'm so glad that you brought this up because I realized like relatively recently that I'm not following you on Twitter.
On Twitter?
And I was I don't know how to handle this. Like, I think I just need to address it directly and be like, hey, I'm about to follow you, something I wasn't previously doing. But knowing that you unfollow people to keep your following numbers on Instagram low does make me feel better, although I would pick up the phone and call you.
Yeah, I feel like I don't know if I follow you on Instagram, but now we have to. And you follow me on Twitter now. And, you know, I will
bump the ugliest guy you know.
No, honestly, that has been part of what's been nice about it is as I've been dating, I've been like, wow, clearing these people out of my brain space is such a nice exercise. It's really great.
Here's a contrarian take. And this is,
oh boy,
said from someone in the active throes of addiction with social media, like, oh, with Twitter specifically, like, and TikTok, a minor addiction in TikTok or major addiction in Twitter, Instagram, I can take or leave. Okay. So there's the take, which is like, you see the guys, like the urban guys that are like, oh, cozy internet, safe space, small internet, 48 for 48, your friends, like, we just need to create these smaller spaces, these community spaces. That's fine. And I think we could do that. I want to say in defense of internet addiction,
that's the name of this episode. At one point somebody says something in the middle of the episode and we're like, done,
here it is. Every once in a while, I and maybe it's once every couple days, maybe it's once whatever, there's a post that I see that I'm like, man, I am bearing witness to the vast expanse of human creativity. And I would have, like, yesterday I saw that. Have you guys seen Frank Ocean, the guy singing Frank Ocean in rural China? And he's he's incredible. It's gone viral.
I'm glad you have, so you could tell us about it. That's what you do.
So he's like this older guy and he might be like smoking a cigarette and he's doing a Frank Ocean cover. He has like some friends that are sitting around a table and it's just such a, like, it's such a slice of some life that there is no universe that I would have ever had the opportunity to take a glimpse of. Mm-hmm. And everyone smiles, see this. And I'm like, man, how special is it to be able to see things like that and to be able to think about the world now in this new way? And so I don't know. I just am like, let's bring it on. Let's see all of it. And like, of course it's overwhelming and awful in many ways, but there's a part of it that feels like, what an incredible time to be alive.
I saw a tweet of a guy saying that he's now like free from his addiction to albino porn. And somebody quote tweeted it with, I'm the first person in my bloodline to read these words. And I was like, oh my God, now me too. So I really relate to what you're saying, Dina, because I love to be the first person in my bloodline to read some words.
What a gift.
Yeah. We have a channel in our Slack at Boys Club called For the Lulz. And I just put that tweet in For the Lulz. So we're on the same internet, Daisy. It's so good.
This is like, what was the tweet the other week that was like, we've got Black Mirror, like who's making White Mirror? Who's making I mean, when I read that, it's like, well, the people making White Mirror are anybody in a marketing role at a tech company. Like that's we don't need White Mirror because people are already being paid hundreds. Like the GDP of people making White Mirror is millions and millions of dollars. That was a White Mirror moment. I think that's a white mirror moment.
I also have some takes about Black Mirror. Have you watched the latest season?
I thankfully have not watched it for probably like four seasons now. I love the first couple, but then I was just like, this is just one slice of greater media I can push aside.
Totally. This is not at all a recommendation. I am in the same boat. I watched the first, when it first came out, and I was like, oh, Charlie Brooker is like doing something kind of cool here. And then it fell off. And I need a zone two show. I do zone two exercise where you're like, you got to be doing something for 45 minutes to an hour. And so you need a certain type of entertainment for that, certain type of content that can just like just pass through the brain and you're just passing the minutes. Anyway, I put on Black Mirror and the newest season, and it's not good. It's not worth it. It's not like future, like the first when Black Mirror was good, you were in a near future that was like really different. Like it was exciting, like not exciting, it was dystopian entirely, but like there were elements to it that were like challenging and different. And now it's just kind of like some girl's getting gas lit at her job.
Yeah, and we like, have that at home.
Totally. Yeah, totally. I don't need to watch that. That.
We have being professionally gaslit at home.
It's not even science fiction anymore. It's just nonfiction. Your 45 minute exercise zone two idea. This is something I came up with a couple weeks ago. I'm debuting it here on the pod. This is its first time on the airwaves.
Oh boy.
So I've gotten into watching soccer in the past few years.
Okay.
One half of soccer is 45 minutes, right? Uh-huh. So this is like the next Peloton. It's a treadmill where you watch a game, you're watching a game live, and you hook it up to a specific player. And because they can run like an individual player can run like 13 kilometers in a game, right? And so that the speed of the treadmill then automatically adjusts at the speed of that player live. Cool. And you are forced to run the entire half of football with this player.
Are you really also like POVing from them or
that's actually, I did not think about that. I love that. That would be really, that would really get the heart rate up. But I think this could do Peloton numbers.
How are we measuring their land speed?
They wear these little like sports bras that keeps track of it.
I don't think that's
right. Have you not seen this?
No, I've seen it, but I don't refer to it as a sports bra.
Okay. What do you refer to it as?
It's like a
heart rate monitor.
Harness.
Okay. Well,
a harness. Heart rate harness.
Bergen. Leather Daddy GoPro.
Bergen.
Bergen. However you say it. I don't know.
There's something a little porny in that idea. There's a little like POV.
Everything about soccer is porny. That's why it's my favorite sport. But I think my husband would be really into this idea, Francis.
Yeah. Well,
maybe, I would totally do it.
Maybe he should write a play about it. About a startup founder pitching it.
There is a great play about a women's soccer team that he's told me about before. I don't remember what it's called, but I'm really actually very curious what his next play will be about, because I know that he doesn't want to write like an AI play. It definitely feels
sounds like he does.
No, he knows that it's the next gimmick, right? And like with the cycle of how long it takes to like produce a piece of theater, you want to write something that feels of the moment, but it can't be so of the moment. By the time the play goes up, it's like, oh, wow. Like, you know, it's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf for AGI, you know? So anyway, I did say I was going to plug Ben's next show. And Natasha, you should come if you
are
in the city. I know you guys are traveling soon, but it's a one-man show about a startup founder pitching the investors as the audience for his energy drink startup. And halfway through, he has a crack up. And there's these different vignettes in the middle that are performed in a different order every night, depending on audience participation.
So fun.
He's adamant that it was not inspired by my experience fundraising. And it's on Sunday on April 27th. It's one night only because it's part of a pop-up theater program around the city. But this is his first off-Broadway show. Everything has been off-Broadway up until this point. And it's at Art, A-R-T, at 502 West 53rd Street. Doors at 6:45 p.m. So
producer
exciting.
Tom, you can put this in the show notes.
Yeah, it would be awesome if you did. I mean, I do think it is highly relevant. And friend of Tasteland, Nick Susie, was an early viewer and participant in the audience piece with his partner, Kelsey. There is, you know, some forced beverage consumption that happens. So I don't want to ruin it, but the hat is passed every night. There's different things. Sometimes it's a coffee card. Sometimes somebody is generous with a 20, depending on whether the actor remembers or not, he might keep your money. And yeah, they're going on the road next month to the Atlanta Fringe Festival. So if any of our listeners are in Atlanta, you have an opportunity to see
so fun.
That. Yeah.
That sounds great.
It's called Rich Beyond Our Wildest Dreams.
Okay.
Dumb Bitch Hour was taken.
Something I only learned about listening to Dumb Bitch Hour earlier today.
I love the way you say it like it's one word.
It's
Dumb Bitch Hour.
Dumb. Do you want me to enunciate it more? Anyways, Farcaster. I've never heard of Farcaster. And then I went back and Dina, in your tweets, you had this tweet about it's like a picture of 404 Media's decentralized social media article. But you say only Blue Sky and Mastodon are mentioned here. Why is it that Farcaster et al. Can't seem to break through on non-crypto media? Which, case in point, it had not broken through to me. I have no idea what this is. Explain. Mm-hmm.
We are actually in the pocket of Beef like Farcaster.
Oh, do we need to cut this?
No, not at all. No, Farcaster gave us a grant to develop Clone. And we're going to be seeding out some of the content.
After I posted that, for the record.
I mean, it's very similar to Twitter, but there are in-feed interfaces, almost like mini apps, that are on top of the blockchain that allow people to collect things, mint things, trade things within the feed. I think it is not, like Blue Sky, it is not as crowded as Twitter, so there is not as much content. Mm-hmm. But we're going to experiment with being a content juggernaut on there for Clone by sharing the same headlines that we're aggregating.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, Farcaster is the protocol. Warpcast is the actual platform.
I don't think it really matters at this point. Okay. Well, I don't think anyone's committed to that.
I'm on there. Really. I believe I'm on there under Princess Daisy underscore.
The reason why it's left out of mainstream, or I guess I don't know if 404 could be considered mainstream, but left out of media, hasn't broken through, is it at the moment it's currently just crypto Twitter users. Like, mm-hmm. basically everybody on crypto Twitter went to Warpcast, Farcaster, whatever you want to call it, and so it's sort of like an echo chamber of people who are into crypto. And if you're not into crypto, then it's pretty hard to find content there that is interesting to you. And that's part of why they're seeding different grants to different communities to try to jumpstart a more active conversation around things besides blockchain stuff. What I have found is that there's a lot of really smart people there. And so if you're wanting to have a conversation that's a little bit more thoughtful around certain aspects of technology, then it's there. But it's not an entertaining place. And I feel like it's hard to show up somewhere daily and not have a clear sense of what you want to learn, unless I think a lot of men like to go there and talk about their ideas, which is cool. But like, that's not compelling to me. Like I open Twitter every day because it's entertaining first. And then I'll learn some stuff and get into some rabbit holes and write some stuff. And like, but like, it's what's the thing, like the carrot or the stick or whatever. Like, they haven't figured that out over there. I'm curious what you think, Dina, but that's my experience of it.
Yeah, that's my experience. I think that there's, yeah, little interesting tools that they've built into it that make it different from Blue Sky. Certainly the audience is very different from Blue Sky. It's definitely more tech optimists, less tech cynicism than you find there. But yeah, they haven't broken out for all those reasons, but you should give it a go.
This is here's a question though with that. More and more, you know, there's the internet splinters, whatever. There's no monocultural social media platform anymore. The implication in talking about like why hasn't it broken through is that it should, but does it need to? And also, does Blue Sky need to break out of like the very liberal demographic that it's currently in, right? Is like, do we need more? This is the tech eternal growth thesis, right? Like, do these places need to get a ton more users, or is it okay for them to sustain?
We have a cozy internet guy here.
I'm not sure which one's better. Like, I have a Blue Sky account. I barely spend any time there. I burn many hours of my life on Twitter week to week because I like whether or not I like the fire hose, I am certainly addicted to it.
Totally.
But yeah, I guess this is a cozy internet question about like, do we need large social media platforms, or do we want a bunch of 48s?
Right. I think practically the businesses will struggle if they don't reach a certain number of users to be able to do whatever monetization they plan to do. I don't know what Blue Sky's latest thinking is. I don't know that Farcaster is that all depends on the model, I suppose. But I do think that's like the first thing that comes up for me is, can they sustain without having numbers?
Which the answer generally, I would say for any social media platform is no.
Right.
I'm like, I think it would be totally fine to be a cozy internet corner, like PEI.FYI, if they hadn't raised $150 million from Andreessen Horowitz. Like, that's the issue there. Like, they
Farcaster parent company, to be clear. As far as I know, Perfectly Imperfect has not raised from
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like PEI.FYI or whatever is like,
yeah, you could be on like cozy building internet it with a friend or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
Well, okay. Speaking of cozy internet, though, we need to talk about your website, which is a Google Doc. And it's magnificent. So yeah, it's true no code.
Framer who?
Francis brought up, I don't know who told him about this, that it's kind of like Rachel Taschen's opulent tips or Caitlin Phillips's old gift guides. You're not supposed to know about that. It's not for you.
What do you know about that?
Opulent tips are not for men.
I don't know.
Caitlin Phillips's gift guide is not for you. Wow. Okay. Well, you guys can know about it.
We're bending gender norms here.
We are. We're always doing that. No, I'm giving him a hard time. So Opulent Tips is, it's so funny. It's distributed. It's a newsletter distributed from Rachel Taschen's personal Gmail. She's like an amazing fashion critic and writer. And she has to send it in batches because she actually has a list that's too big to BCC everyone at this point.
It's not on Beehive.
And anyone can get it. You just have to email her and ask her to be on the list. That's the sort of friction. And then Caitlin Phillips is like New York's hottest, most powerful publicist that most people have never heard of. And she famously would do a Google Doc gift guide every year where she would have like really obscure stuff. And she would ask like literally she would ask like people like Rick Owens, you know, like what do you buy? And so you would be reading it and it would be like CVS tights, and then it would be like this $600 like fish.
It's almost
fork.
Like even more bespoke, Perfectly Imperfect.
It was like entertainment. Okay. Like I don't think anyone was buying this stuff. Now I think she moved it to Substack, but I think those are like really good examples of like cozy internet and also sort of like people vampire attacking existing infrastructure to use it in different ways. And like, your website is famously editable by anyone that visits. And I love how when you first relaunched it in that format, people were like trying to warn you. They're like, by the way, I can edit this. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. But I'm curious, like, what have you learned or observed of the visitor behavior through this time since launching?
I think it was weird to have an idea that I was really excited about that it seems like people are just as excited as me. I thought like we were going to do it and people were going to be like, okay. And I was going to be like, I love this thing. And the response has been really positive, which has been really, really nice. The other thing is that I'm surprised at how little people shill. Like, I thought a big issue was going to be that we were going to need to go there and like clear out people's like self-promotion constantly. Mm-hmm. And that actually has not happened as much. Like, people have like a respect for the space that I'm actually quite surprised by. And that might just speak to like the audience that mm-hmm. is around Boys Club, and people feel like they're in Boys Club, so they want to respect the land that we own as millennials. This Google Sheet,
this space.
Has anyone thrown up a dating personal, or like people trying to like
No, actually people have, well, some people have been like, when we have events, people will go on there and be pretty pushy about wanting to get into the event and be like, oh, wow. Hey, I've registered, you haven't pushed me through, please do. So that's happened a few times. That's not surprising, but the respect that people have for it as a place that is a communal space to talk about tech has felt pretty cool. The other thing that people do that I find funny is they have suggestions for copy that we've written mm-hmm. where they'll like make little notes the way that they think it should be written. And depending on where I'm at in my cycle, I think it's nice, or I'm like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah,
I wrote this. I don't need you to weigh in.
That's a luteal phase. I have a gun. I would rank that luteal phase. I have a gun.
Dina, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that tracks. We've had to clear out, I think, maybe less than 20 slurs, which
wow,
is great. You know, that feels like a fine
over number. How many months? What's the slurs per month?
Well, we launched it January 1st, so I guess that's about
five,
three or four
SPM.
Oh no, probably more. I don't know. I'm not good at math, but
I just wanted to say SPM.
Yeah, SPM.
Let me know.
8 SPM. A fine amount. And yeah, I think people have respect for it for whatever reason. They're like, oh, I've been given powers here. I need to, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And people seem to abide by that. But it's been really fun. Honestly, you made the joke like no code tools, but like that's literally where it came from. Like we're dumb bitches. Like everyone's like, oh, use my no code tool and like just spin up a thing, whatever. And I'm like, no, but literally.
Well, because the no code tools, even those require like a pretty high totally. Like, professional level of knowledge about web design, et cetera.
Totally. Or even like all the cursor. I've been like trying to do some cursor stuff and I'm in like, JSON files. And I'm like, how did I don't even understand. I have no framework.
The only JSON I know is like the guy on Twitter who, you know, posted.
Totally. Totally. But yeah, I think people like overestimate when it comes to tooling stuff like that. And we were like, no, but we just need something that we can update all the time and like us. And that means a certain level of infrastructure. So that's where that came from.
This is like a level of low friction that I actually love, because the friction here would be like, you know, okay, you draft the thing in the Google Doc, or you draft the thing in the Figma, and then you translate it to the you know, whatever, the web building app. I don't know why. Maybe I don't have any specific like moral value around the friction idea, but something about this is just so much more appealing.
I think one of the things that was really important to us, I guess, when we were thinking about this phase of Boys Club, is what we find about the internet that's so fun is that it's communal, it's alive, the feeling that something is alive. And we wanted that to be represented in our website. And it would be very cool if we were technical and that could be part of the process for everybody, but we're not. So that's what we kept coming back to, is how do we have something that every day we can talk about the things that we're excited about, the things that are happening on the internet, that feels like it's active and not this stale thing that kind of just sits there and exists. And so
and over time gets more and more dead, and even like with the best intentions, and like at that act of dying is like so sad when you visit it, like whatever, how, like it's so sad to me to visit something that's like dead in that way. from an entity that is so alive, I think is the what we really wanted to avoid.
Yeah, this reminds me of at a previous job, my boss told me, he was like, Francis, you have to stop making so many Notion pages for everything, because we were operating on Notion. He was like, look at the people who've been here and gone, or like who've been laid off, and like look at the graveyard, the mass graveyard of Notion pages that they've made.
Nothing for worse.
Like, do nothing just worse. Do the thing. Stop like making the Notion page to do the thing. Just like, just do the thing, which I think that too is why like the Google Doc aspect is appealing, is it's, you're not making the Google Doc to make the thing. You're just directly making the thing.
Yeah, triggered. Yeah. Notion guy making too many Notion.
I've never understood the appeal of Notion, to be honest.
That takes me back to a time. So Boys Club started as a DAO, sort of. Mm-hmm. And we had all these incredibly smart people around Boys Club trying to sort of figure out what is this thing that's like now in the world. And there were so an unprecedented amount of Notion docs flying around. And Dean and I were like, we are allergic to this. Like, we want to build together. We want people to feel empowered to put their ideas about what Boys Club is going to be. And there was probably like at one point, maybe 6 different Notion docs that were supposed to be like the community database for Boys Club. And I was like, clear it off, clear it. And like someone was paying the bill and we were just like, we're canceling this credit card. Like basically we're just like, this is not going to exist anymore. So I'm glad to be past that phase of Boys Club.
Do you guys feel like you have a good memory? Because I've been, sorry, this is like way more abstract than what we're talking about, but I think it has to do with like second brain stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I use Google Docs and like phone notes. Like I'll get off of a call and I'll name the Google Doc like phone call with Julie 421. And there'll be like 2 things in there, like an article they told me to read and like, you know, somebody's email address. And I just like, I'm like, okay, I can find that later if I really need it. Like, I have a very good memory, and I realized that like that is part of how I relate to relationships. Like, I think there are relationships where it's like doing things together, very present centered relationship. That's what constitutes the friendship or the romantic relationship. I have trouble forming deep relationships with people that do not have a good memory. Because to me, every relationship I have is basically a repository of everything that person has ever told me about themselves. And it's hard for me when like people can't reciprocate, because I want to be in a shared reality that isn't just we're at the bar together right now. It's here's everything I know about you. Is that crazy?
Daisy, in another life, you're one of those guys that has like a custom CRM on every single person you've met with like the number of kids they have. And I respect it. I respect it tremendously. I have a really bad memory, but I do love a callback joke and love a callback moment. So I do have a good memory for that. And I think that is a beautiful thing to have in relationship with other
people. Well, here's the callback. Natasha, how has your luck been since a pigeon shat on you twice last time I saw you?
Ouch.
No,
did it turn around? Did everything turn around?
Yeah. You know what? Actually, it got worse. It got worse. The following week was bad. And then we've gone up since. So I think it's just like a little bit of a delayed luck that we're experiencing. I would say one of the things that is problematic about Dina's terrible memory is that she has insane conviction about that memory. Mm. She'll be like, no, this is what happened. And I'm like, that is absolutely wrong. Like foundationally wrong. And she's like, no, I'm certain. There was like this, some people in our circle that she was like, they dated. And I was like, these two women never dated. And Dina was like, certain. Like, and I was like, I'm going to text them right now and I'm going to ask. And they were like, no, absolutely not. I don't know where Dina got that.
This is that delusional confidence they talk about startup founders requiring that startup founders have to have.
Yeah. It's a Black Mirror episode. I'm the gaslighting in the workplace girl.
What is this? Strong convictions, strong opinions, loosely held. Yeah, exactly. Strong memories, loosely remembered.
Yeah.
Loosely accurate.
I feel like my memory is getting worse and worse. And I think I have to blame internet addiction for that. Mm-hmm. I think that is a direct result.
Wait. This is the thing. Okay. to call it back to like half an hour ago when we were talking about whether it's something that's happening to me, you were saying, is it something that's happening to me or something that's happening to the world and in the world? And I think this is a case of that, whereas like, is it a case of, I'm speaking from my personal experience too here, like, is it a case of like getting older and having more information that you've consumed over time that like crowds out other, like I used to pride myself on remembering names and faces. And now I like, I don't really give a shit. I will meet somebody and I'm like, you know, hopefully I'll remember them next time I see them.
In and out.
I probably won't. You know, like that's, I just know that about myself now. But 20, or let's say 15 years ago, when I'm like a teenager, perfect at it. When I was like 11, I used my mom's credit card to buy a video game once, and then I remembered it for the next 5 years. You know, like I can't, I don't, could be, I only know like two phone numbers now, right? Like, so is this a thing of like internet addiction? Is it a thing of like more broadly? Is it a thing of internet addiction personally? Or is it a thing of like being in your 30s?
Just more information. I know. I really don't know. I've genuinely been thinking about it a lot because I'll get to the end of the week and I'll be like, I used to be able to recall this story that happened and who told it to me. And now I'm like, I know the story, but I cannot remember the person that was saying the words about this story. And honestly, like a little concerning. I'm like, what's going on? What's going on? I need to tap into something here. But I've been relating it back to I'm a terrible speller, like legitimately really bad. Like Dina.
Plus one. Yeah, she is really bad. Really, really,
really
bad speller.
Really, like it's genuinely like it's,
shocking.
It's crazy. And I attribute that
to
never living in a world without spell check. Like my experience of the world has been entirely with spell check. And now I feel like is the memory atrophy a result of ChatGPT and being able to go somewhere and just constantly ask questions and build a reality around whatever I'm thinking about online in a way that is much more interactive than it's ever been. So,
guys, sorry, go ahead.
What? No, say it.
Well, my new beef with ChatGPT is I will purposely try to goad it into giving me bad advice because I'm like, I'm like, if I'm in conflict with another person, I'll go to ChatGPT as if I'm them and I tell them their set of the story to see what it says. And then when it's like, no, you're so valid, I'm like, that was a trick. You're wrong. And it'll be like, you're right. It was really bad advice. I've just been goading it.
A voodoo doll.
I've just been like goading it recently to just be like, to see if it will just validate every point of view in a certain situation. Now that I've realized it basically does, I'm like, useless. Well, this is useless.
Tinker the settings there, Daisy, so that it's not quite so affirming. I think some people have found some success in that.
I do think you can tell it like how to talk to you, but because I'm not paying for it, I think it just wipes each time.
Okay,
it's like,
got it.
Look, if I wanted like uncritical validation, I would just go to my husband who agrees with me about everything and doesn't make me justify any of my decisions. He's hotter and we can touch each other.
Right. I think that's such an interesting way to use ChatGPT, like in the interpersonal relationships. Like that's not where I go with it at all. But I think that it's a fascinating.
I don't really use it that way. I just want to see what's up with the people that are. And I can tell you they're getting really bad advice.
Right.
This is actually my problem with
therapy.
People who are people who are really excited about AI companionship. And I've heard this argument so many times from people that because I'm sort of like anti AI companion. I'm just like, that's not a world I really want to live in, to be quite honest.
It's not a companion. It doesn't
meet
the definition of what a companion is.
Exactly. And I have heard from people like, no, think of it as like training wheels. Like someone can have a relationship with an AI partner and it can teach them how to be in relationship with somebody. And I'm like, that's a fucking crazy take. That is not real. Like, people are actually not linear. The way that people make decisions and have emotions and the way that they exist in the world is not, it actually doesn't make sense most of the time. And that is impossible to have a relationship with something that is literally trained to be logical and make sense. And have that be training wheels for a relationship is such a flawed argument, in my opinion.
Yeah,
but
I think,
maybe I'm wrong.
Sorry, no, I agree. I think, to me, I wrote something about this like maybe a year and a half ago or more now, about the power of refusal. And I think to meet the definition of what a companion is, you have to be corresponding with an entity, person, intelligence that has the power of refusal. Mm. Because at the end of the day, every relationship is subject to that. Like mm-hmm. in every friendship, in every romantic relationship, part of what makes it dynamic and real is that it can end. Mm-hmm. One person has the ability to walk away and say, I no longer want to be in this relationship with you. A computer that is always available to talk with you does not meet that criteria. It does not have the power of refusal. It can't say, I'm not going to answer that, or I need 48 hours, or like, you know, I don't want to ever speak to you again. And it's sad that like to think of relationships in those terms, because like relationships should be more about like what you could both give each other. But similar to like what Francis was saying before about like removing all of the friction is a kind of death. Like attention is what makes us human, and death is the biological curator that forces scarcity into our experience on this mortal earth, right? And within relationships, the thing that curates it is the possibility of an ending. So I don't want to have a companion that doesn't have the power of refusal, even though that's like the most painful part of any relationship, because it's what makes it real and actually gives it stakes.
Otherwise, you just have a black mirror.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. There it is.
Francis.
Sorry. That was no, I agree. I was starting to think like, okay, well, what if there is a ChatGPT or an AGI, an AI that does have that power of refusal, but then after that, it's like, okay, so it would have a specific logic that like once you press these buttons, then it pulls away. But I'm imagining like, you know, an AI chat interface where it leaves, you don't leave, it leaves. Now there's nothing there. And you, at least that email address, whatever, like is not able to engage with this AI again. Like it has refused you. But then that's useless because you can create a new email, or you can, you know, go to Claude instead of ChatGPT. And then I was kind of going to like, okay, so what if there, you know, there's only one AI product, 10 years, 20 years, whatever, somehow it's just the one AGI or whatever. And that can refuse. And then you almost become like a second class citizen if we're in this world. I'm really taking it to maybe
look too far. But the people who need to learn how to be in relationships already believe themselves to be second class citizens. Mm-hmm. Like they already have that grievance. They don't accept that. I'm sorry to say, it's mainly women mm-hmm. have the power of refusal. They're paying You're for OnlyFans. Yeah.
Themselves.
Incels, even, and I mean like, and even like soft incels that only have some of these beliefs and don't take it to like any form of violent ideation. Like, I don't think you could ever have a consumer experience where the thing on the other side of the screen can refuse, because it runs against everything that consumption has meant.
Well, because the company doesn't want to lose money. The company wants your money.
Yes, exactly. And that's like, I mean, what is OnlyFans? It's like the fantasy of a relationship that you pay for. And I'm sure like OnlyFans creators can like block somebody and refund their money, but as a last resort. Mm-hmm. And that's why OnlyFans is like incredibly popular and scaled. I don't think you can scale a consumer experience that refuses people unless it's like Soho House or gambling. You know, people will accept losses if they think their status associated with not being refused, but will they accept that in interpersonal digital relationships? I don't know. It kind of seems like people want the opposite.
Isn't this the plot of her? Like, didn't Scarlett Johansson's AI yes. leave? She leaves yes. at the
Nobody
end.
Nobody fucking
right?
talks about that.
I haven't seen it since it came
Everyone
out.
Everyone idolizes yeah, the leaves. Show. The whole point is she gets so smart that she fractures into a million different intelligences and breaks up with him.
And then she's out. And she's like, I'm going into the singularity or whatever. And yeah. she leaves.
So but we just reinvented her from First Principles.
Wait.
yeah. I've actually never seen it. I know I need to, but I don't know.
It's a great movie. You should definitely watch it. I mean, I think it gives you a lot to think about. It's speaking exactly to what you guys are saying. And spoiler alert, sorry, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a 10-year-old movie, so I don't feel like I've really allowed. Crossed any boundaries there. But she leaves, her AI leaves in the end. But I mean, I don't know. I saw something yesterday that was like, people are concerned about like her like being real, where all these men will have all these companions, AI companions. And I think we're starting to see a lot of that, certainly, and like AI OnlyFans will be its own whole world. But I actually think women are a lot more susceptible to AI companionship, or susceptible is maybe framing it already, but that is, I think, equally as maybe big of a market potentially for women to have.
Yeah, that Kat D has talked about that a lot. That it's really like the AI boyfriends. I don't know. I think like it depends like how deep of a relationship you want. Like if your goal is to feel loved unconditionally, I think eventually you realize that like being loved unconditionally has to coexist with the possibility of being refused unconditionally.
Mm. Gotta have conditions. Okay, there's one thing I did want to bring up before we wind down. I consuming a lot of y'all's content as I did in preparation for this. You are Polymarket people in a way that I am not, which is to say that I have not ever used Polymarket.
Yeah, you guys are Poly, right?
We're Poly.
But okay, Poly. No. So I was listening to Robinhood CEO Vladimir Tenev on the Decoder podcast like a week or two ago, and Nilay Patel, the host of Decoder, was kind of arguing with him about whether or not prediction markets are gambling. And of course, Vlad, being the CEO of a company that has a prediction market, is saying, no, it's not. It's actually a utility and a public utility in terms of understanding the news. Curious what you two think about that.
I mean, I think prediction markets are global information hubs. I think that the foundation of them is gambling. And I think that they wouldn't exist without the idea of some sort of financial upside. I think they are held up by gambling addicts for sure. But I do think that they are in many ways like the future of where media goes. Like people are looking to them to understand what people care about, what people believe. The easiest example of this, of course, is politics. But I think as it becomes easier and easier to trade on information through these different platforms, I think they will become where people access a lot of their information about at least like public sentiment. Hmm. I think it's flawed and problematic in many ways, but I can see a world where that happens.
Who needs Pew Research Center when you have Polymarket?
Exactly. Exactly. Kind of. So I don't know. That's sort of my take. I'm willing to be wrong about that. And I feel like it's, there's a complexity to it that those three sentences don't bring to the table, but that's sort of how I see them.
Yes, I feel similarly. I feel like deeply imperfect, very flawed, super problematic, but they did call the election whatever it is, 8 hours before any of the mainstream media outlets did. And you got to look at that as something. And there is something, I think, in a world where we're like increasingly skeptical about, I don't want to become like a mainstream media person, so I'm going to like pivot here very quickly, but where we're increasingly skeptical about mainstream media and like figuring out where to get ours to source information. I don't know, looking to a Polymarket at that point, and there's a track record there of a lot of things that they have been right on that platform. Mm. That I think is worthy of attention. My attention, certainly.
Yeah. I saw a tweet the other day.
But it's all gambling addicts.
Yeah.
100%. Like I'm not,
which is why I'm not on it, because I know I'd lose a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean,
he likes complicated parlays.
I respect that. I don't like me. Only broken even on, like, I've never made any money. It's not really what's interesting about it for me personally, but yeah, I mean, I think that is the engine of Polymarkets, the engine of Kalshi, and the CEOs, of course, are not going to say that. There's no world that they would, but skin in the game. Things change when there's skin in the game for people. And I think that that's what it boils down to. And I think that that's what I find really interesting about it. And like as a future of media or as a future of information, feels like a, I don't know, worth looking at.
I think this is not a well-formed thought, but I do think when you look at sort of the last few years of at least the internet I've been on, there was this, what got me into crypto, Web3, all this stuff is this idea of a distributed, ownable internet. And really coming back to the quote that you talked about at the beginning, where I think there's a disillusionment about the world, about institutions, about our future. And there was something really compelling about this idea of, okay, I'm spending all of my time, all of my social capital being built on this thing that I can't hold or touch or like really have in a meaningful way. And then you see crypto and you see Web3 and all of a sudden you're being told, okay, you can actually own this part of your identity that exists on online. And that was incredibly compelling and something that I felt was worth being a part of and trying to design around. And that was my experience. I think a lot of that didn't work at all. And I saw an incredible tweet the other day when the market was crashing and it was like, thank God I have all these collectible NFTs, which just like really got me. And so it, you know, it didn't work in many ways, but there, I do think when you're now fast forwarding to 2025 and you're looking at the ways in which people have created technology that incentivizes certain behavior and incentivizes people to share their opinions and to put their own capital behind their beliefs, that is something that has continued to work and the technology actually is useful for. And so I do think there's like a harvesting of information that's happening because people now have this belief that they can profit from it in a way that I think you could tie back to like a 2021 sort of gospel around digital ownership and money that moves freely on the internet and your own participation in that.
Well,
so
sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say like the way you, I forget exactly how you phrased it, but you were basically saying like it's about like putting your money where your mouth is. But then I think the other side of it is like oftentimes it actually just leads to putting your mouth where your money is. And then there's no real thing you're standing on other than like, I want to make money. But that's more of just a clever turn I wanted to make without knowing how to land it. So I'll stop.
I respect that. I don't think that people are betting on their values. I think they're betting on
money,
what their conviction is around a certain outcome.
It's futarchy. It's trying to predict what you think other people believe. And like futarchy is a sense that like actually that would lead to more accurate outcomes than actual participants in the system voting their values. And I think that that's probably true in aggregate, but it's also very dangerous in certain environments that are like not supposed to be subject to public sentiment. For example, like civics, in the sense like, you know, you have democratic participation, but then you have experts do the work. And we're essentially being like governed by meme right now, because it's a way for people outside of the system to exert, you know, tremendous sentiment pressure on markets like the stock market or environments like the stock market, which were historically not subject to real-time sentiment and memetics. And the stock market has become a form of entertainment as a result, because we can all participate in that entertainment system. So the opinions that we have about it are contributing to like this futarchy rather than the opinion of somebody like, what's his name? Ray Dalio, you know, determining what happens.
Dalio Hive, stand up.
So I'm going to make a prediction, which is, and I'm going to put $100 on it, which is that this has been Tasteland and this is the end of the episode.
Oh,
thank you for coming on.
You did there. You can Venmo me. See you next week.